From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made 8 days ago on the front page of the Democrat and Chronicle. A story by education reporter Justin Murphy detailed the ways that some local charter schools operate. And in particular, Murphy wrote about financial and management practices that the piece termed, in some cases, questionable. We reached out to the Northeast Charter Schools Network several times last week, offering a chance to come on the panel today or to do a pre-recorded interview that we could play in full. No one was available for either option. We also reached out to E3, which was not specifically examined in the piece, but which covers a couple of local charter schools. And initially, a couple of folks affiliated with E3 agreed to come on the program, but last night they decided not to do so, saying they didn't want to be seen as speaking for the entire charter schools community, particularly in light of Justin Murphy's reporting. So perhaps in the coming weeks, we'll have a chance to talk to people representing E3. Today, we do have a panel to discuss the piece and its implications, starting with the reporter. Justin Murphy is an education reporter with the Democrat and Chronicle. Justin, thanks for being here.
Hi, Evan.
Shaggy Tell is an associate professor of social foundations of education at Nazareth College. And Shaggy, nice to have you here.
Good to be here.
In studio is David Hirsch, professor of teaching and curriculum at the University of Rochester's Warner School of Education and the author of the new book, The End of Public Schools, The Corporate Reform Agenda to Privatize Education. David, thanks for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
And on the phone with us is Jeff Rosenberger, who is the board chair of Rochester Prep. It's a group of five charter schools in Rochester. Jeff, thanks for taking the time. How are you?
Happy to do it. I'm great.
And Jeff, just a little bit of background. My understanding is the five charter schools under Rochester Prep, 1,587 local children, you say, 85% are on free and reduced price lunch, 97% of the kids at those schools are minority.
That's correct.
Okay. Justin, let's start with just kind of an understanding of what the mission of the piece is. And it was a long piece that I know you spend a lot of time working on. The name of the piece is Charter Schools: As Movement Grows, Oversight Lags. And give us a sense for the mission here. This is an important subject. Your newspaper today put out some of the new findings in the Unite Rochester poll. 71% of people surveyed in this poll say that they want to see charter schools as an option growing, that they essentially support what they're seeing with charter schools. So the community has got growing support for charter schools. What were you trying to do here?
So the idea in the story was to sort of examine the way that money moves through charter school organizations, and in particular through this one at the center of it. It's Discovery Charter School, which is in Greece, and that's part of the Education Success Network. And kind of all the Byzantine workings of these organizations are in the story. But a distinguishing feature of charter schools is that because they're a lot smaller than a public traditional school district, they rely a little bit more heavily on contracted services sometimes for administration, for curriculum, for professional development, for information technology, those sorts of things. So I sort of stumbled upon this story with Discovery Charter School, and the story looks at a lot of those contracts and the different relationships that Discovery Charter School has and within the Education Success Network, which also includes Norman Howard School and Compass Tutoring Company. And kind of the point of it was that all these different organizations with which it affiliates were all actually controlled by the same people. And as a result of that, the money was moving around in ways that it wasn't necessarily always easy to track. And maybe inevitably, when you're doing that much self-dealing, the books got crossed a few different times. So it looks at not only what happened in that case, but the oversight framework that exists for charter schools and sort of the facts on the ground that in some cases allow that sort of thing to happen.
Now, I can't ask Justin to perfectly sum up a long piece and a months-long investigation. I will say to listeners, best thing we all can do is we discuss this throughout the hour is if you haven't read the piece yet, find time to read it. Try to read it in full. You know, there's nothing more frustrating to reporters than people commenting on pieces they haven't read. And even though it is a lengthy piece, it is worth reading start to finish so we can at least kind of get on the same page here. But let me turn to Jeff Rosenberger, because I know Jeff's time is more limited on the panel today. And Jeff had a number of concerns with some of the way that various things were characterized. In particular, Jeff, I know that you had some frustration with concerns about saying that public schools, or I should say charter schools, are public schools that essentially are privately run. And Jeff, give me a sense for why you have a problem with that.
Well, because they are public schools. They're not privately run. Oh. They're run by boards of trustees But those boards of trustees have to be approved by the chartering entity, either SUNY or the Board of Regents. The students take the same exams as district schools take. The board meetings are all subject to open meeting law, the New York State open meeting law, as are district schools. The reports that charter schools have to file with the state education department are voluminous. So it's not like Harley or Allendale or McQuaid or Aquinas, where they're private entities and they can pretty much operate their schools the way they want. The rules around charter schools are extensive and rigid, and these are public schools in every sense of the word. They're just not district schools.
All right, so Justin, why did you characterize it that way in the piece?
So I agree with Jeff. They are not the same as Harley and Aquinas. They're public schools, but the reason that we say that they're run by private entities, for one thing, is that very often these schools, including Discovery and also including Rochester Prep, are run by separate nonprofit in New York. They're nonprofit called EPOs. They're provider organizations that provide a lot of the curriculum and various services. And the second thing is that the boards of trustees, while they are approved by the chartering organization, are appointed, not elected. So that's not something that we, I think, recognize as the way that public entities usually work. You don't appoint public school boards, for instance.
Okay, so Jeff, thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, yes, it's true, but, you know, the is SUNY a public organization? Because its board isn't elected.
Yeah, it is a public organization. So we can get into this a little bit more. There's two reasons, I think, that set charter schools apart. Jeff is absolutely right that they're subject to open meeting law and freedom of information law. If you read the story, you'll know I relied very heavily on those documents. But there are two important practical differences. The first one is that by the nature of the size of charter schools in general, there's, depending on how you count them, about 15 charter schools in Rochester. Each of them have somewhere between 100 to several hundred students, which makes them about the size of a small to medium-sized traditional public school, but they each have their own budget process and board of directors. So for me, for instance, my job is to keep track of all schools in the Rochester area, it's impractical for a reporter or even interested public members to pay as much attention to each of those different meetings and processes going on as you would to a traditional school. The Rochester City School District, because of the number of employees and parents and everything else that it has thousands of eyes on it all the time. That's not the case for charter schools. And I think the second important point is, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of the services that charters have are contracted out. And now that's not a bad thing in theory. That's perfectly fine, and it's reasonable that they would need to contract for them. You wouldn't expect a school to develop an entire administrative framework like a traditional district if it only has a few hundred students. But because those things are contracted, then the services provided in those contracts and the organizations that are provided them, that's the sort of information that in a traditional public district would be important for people to have access to, and it's not always the case in the exact same way.
Jeff Rosenberg, why don't you jump in there as well, and then I'm going to turn to the panelists in studio as well. But Jeff, go ahead.
Well, again, those contracts have to be approved by the chartering entity. So there is oversight. There's enormous oversight. I mean, all leases have to be approved by the building leases have to be approved by the chartering entities. And you know, when you talk about contracting out, to give you an example, at Rochester Prep, we contract out with Uncommon Schools to run the schools on a day-to-day basis. Uncommon Schools is a network of 44 schools, all not-for-profit, and Uncommon is a not-for-profit. Their schools are in six different cities. And we have enormous sharing of knowledge and best practices across those schools. So our students benefit and our families benefit by the fact that an educational innovation that is created in Brooklyn or Boston or Newark can be transported back here to Rochester for our students to benefit from. And also it allows us to benchmark our teachers and our students against these other schools so that we know how we're doing, not just against the district schools, but other schools in other cities.
Let me ask Shaw Gittell about a comment he made in the piece that I thought was one of the strongest comments in the piece, which was this. Here's the quote in Justin's piece. As long as any public service is put under private authority, it can't really serve the public in any meaning of the word, said Shaw Gittell, an education professor at Nazareth College and a vocal critic of charter schools. It can't serve the public in any meaningful way?
So actually, that wasn't, Justin, that wasn't a super exact quote, but we can take the essence of it.
Would you stand by those words?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And let me explain. So one of the things, I've been researching charter schools for about 8 or 9 years, and one of the things I've noticed is that there is extreme confusion on the topic. And it's easy to find all kinds of individuals who have one-liners and bumper sticker statements about charter schools, but to acquire a coherent and integrated outlook on what charter schools actually represent requires very disciplined, uninterrupted study for a long time. So one of the confusions that comes up repeatedly is this public-private distinction. And what's been happening since the late 70s, early 80s, is that this division between the public and the private has been deliberately blurred. And it's part of what's called the neoliberal program, the neoliberal agenda. And it manifests itself in what's called public-private partnerships, or the outright direct privatization of a range of public services.
But why deliberately blur it?
Deliberately blur it because in the context of a failing economy where major owners of capital are under intense pressure to maximize profits and there's no good place to get investments and a reasonable return on investments, then you have to go into the nonprofit sector, the public sector, where there's large pools of public funds, and basically set up pay the rich schemes or these kinds of arrangements that end up transferring and funneling huge sums of public funds, public assets, public facilities to private entities, all under the veneer of high ideals. And so it's very instructive that less than 6 months ago, the Washington State Supreme Court ruled that charter schools are not public schools, and that Greg Richmond, who is the CEO of the National Association of Charter School Associations, in many press releases and many reports, clarifies that oversight and accountability in the charter school sector remains weak. So I would take that issue to task. I would maintain that simply calling something public repeatedly doesn't make it public, and simply receiving public funds doesn't make you public. And there are many aspects to charter schools that they do actually lack many of the public features of public schools. And Justin just mentioned one of them, which is that basically not a single charter school, and there's about 6,500 or 6,700 in the United States, depending on the source you read, are not run by elected public officials.
Let me get back to Jeff Rosenberger for a response. Again, he's the board chair of Rochester Prep. That's a group of 5 charter schools in Rochester. Go ahead, Jeff.
Well, your assumption, you're making the statement that these are being done for profit. All the charter schools operating in Rochester today are not for profit, and the charter management organizations that operate in Rochester today are not for profit. So who's benefiting from this supposed profit grab?
Well, but Jeff, and again, forgive me here, only because I think a not-for-profit banner doesn't mean much. I mean, the NFL is not-for-profit, and its commissioner is making a lot of money. There's a lot of people making a lot of money. So I don't think that banner is ipso facto evidence that there is not potential for profit. But I also think it's fair to ask Shaw Gittell, you don't think anybody in the business community who's investing in charter schools or investing their time, you don't think they're doing it for truly magnanimous reasons? I mean,
that's not the main question. For me, the main question is, as an educational arrangement, what do charter schools represent in the United States? The question of people's intentions, I don't really get into because I don't know people's intentions. But I know the results and the effects of different policies and arrangements. And so we know from work done at the National Education Policy Center that right now, a little more than 44% of charter school students are enrolled in private for-profit schools. Charter schools, and that the comment that most charter schools are nonprofit, that may be true, but it's also true, as Justin pointed out in his article, and so many others have done the same, is that these private nonprofit entities actually engage in all kinds of outsourcing and contracting and for-profit arrangements with what's called secondary providers. I actually just published a piece called Can a Charter School Not Be a Charter School? And it goes deeply into this topic of what is a contract, legally, politically, philosophically, and historically, what is a contract? And ultimately, a contract is quintessentially a market category. And we don't have the time and space to really go deeply into that topic, but I think it clears up some of the confusion surrounding that term.
Jeff Rosenberger.
Well, I think I can't speak, to every charter school, but I can speak to Rochester. All the schools, again, are operating or in Rochester, are not-for-profit. And now I hear what you're saying, but I can also tell you that if you look at the people involved in these schools, because charter schools in New York State receive only 2/3 of the educational funding that district schools receive, and they receive no money for facilities, the vast majority of the trustees of charter schools here in Rochester have made personal financial contributions to those schools. I know at Rochester Prep, our board has given significant dollars, millions of dollars, to acquire facilities for the school. And I think if you look at other charter schools in town, you'll find the same thing. So it's hard for me to understand an allegation of malfeasance when the people who are supposedly benefiting from this are the ones who are actually writing the checks rather than receiving them.
And Jeff, in other words, the article that Justin wrote referenced numerous, quote, prominent names on, for example, one of the charter schools' board of trustees. And what you're simply saying is there's several reasons for that. First of all, Jeff is saying people with means care deeply and they are contributing. They're not just benefiting. They are contributing their own money. And, Jeff, you're also saying that, you know, even though they're public schools, charter schools, operate with less when it comes to taxpayer funding, and therefore you feel like this is one of the ways that you have to do it, yes, to play the game?
That's absolutely correct. I mean, because, again, there's no taxpayer money for charter school facilities. So charter schools are left with two choices. They can raid their programmatic funds to pay for buildings, or they can go out hat in hand to the donor community to try to raise money to put a roof over their children's heads. Now, the fact that charter schools in New York State, or at least in upstate New York, have to go hat in hand to the donor community to beg for money to put a roof over their public school children's heads, to me, is obscene, but that's the way it is. So who is able to raise the millions of dollars that are necessary to acquire and refurbish these schools? Well, it's generally people of some means.
Okay. Shoggy wants to respond to that. Go ahead, Shoggy.
I think it is true that private sector actors do put up some of their own money, but in return for what? And secondly, the Center on Media and Democracy just did a study showing that, I can't remember if it was in the last 10 years or the last 15 years, but the federal government has funneled about $3.7 mm-hmm. billion public dollars to charter schools to help with facilities and that sort of thing. And part of the issue there is that charter schools do not, according to Gary Miron and other researchers, Christopher Lubiansky, do not actually provide as many services and programs and facilities and resources as public schools. And they also have a lot of incentive to avoid what's called high-cost, high-need students, like special education students and English language learners, even though they are supposedly public, supposedly non-sectarian, and supposedly open to all.
All right, Jeff, I know you've made comments in the past about the last part of Shoggy's comments there about English language learners, students with disabilities. What would you say to that?
Well, I have to strongly object to that. If you look at in New York State, again, part of the fact that we're public institutions and not private institutions, the state dictates what can and cannot be on a charter school application. The only thing you can ask is the student's name, their address, their parents or guardian's name, their date of birth, the last grade they completed, and what school they're from. And you can also ask, but the family is not required to answer, whether or not the student is eligible for the federal free and reduced price lunch program. You are not allowed to ask if they're an English language learner, and you are not allowed to ask if they are a special needs student. And so and that's by law. And so our applications come in, and in every charter school, I think in Rochester, there's more applications than there are available seats. And so we have to conduct a lottery, and we choose names. And we have no idea whether the names we choose is a student who is an A student or a B student or a D student or an F student. We have no idea whether English is their first language or their second language. We have no idea if they have any learning disabilities. We take whoever shows up on our doorstep.
All right, well,
and one other comment relative, because I do have to go, but relative to the, what did you say, $3 billion of federal money, let's put that in perspective. In Rochester, New York alone, there is $1 billion of state money going in to refurbish the Rochester City School District buildings. That's one district in one community, and that's a third of the total money that he's talking about federal dollars nationwide. So there's no way you can have a charter school building without private philanthropy.
All right. Now, Shaggy and David are going to be able to be here for the hour, and we will have time to continue the conversation. Jeff's got to run. Before you run, Jeff, because I think any good reporting isn't the end of a conversation, I think it's the beginning or at least a part of the process. Justin Murphy, anything come up to you as the reporter here who's going to be continuing to report on charter schools, operations, management, that you would want to ask Jeff before he has got to get out the door?
Well, I think that the point Jeff brings up about the facilities funding is a valid one, and that's kicking around in the New York State courts right now, and it's certainly going to continue to be a problem, because it's true that whatever you feel about charter schools, whether you think they should exist or not, if they do exist and if there are students getting a public education at them, then it makes sense to provide buildings for that purpose, which we don't know. So I think that maybe Jeff would agree that once you get to that point, or even as you're getting to that point, there's currently stress on the charter school operators to overcome that hurdle. But at the same time, that can't be an excuse for unethical or questionable or even apparently unethical behavior as you're trying to meet those hurdles. So that's something that both sides, I think, need to work on a little bit.
Well, I agree with you, but I mean, just because you have a trustee who happens to be a well-placed public official doesn't mean there's any malfeasance going on.
Well, he didn't happen to be a well-placed public official. He happened to be the executive director of the tutoring company that they work with and the umbrella organization that they work with and another school that is involved and the foundation that they are involved with, and he happened to sign the lease for the school.
So you mentioned several names. One of the people you named Norman Howard happens to be an alum of the school and was involved with the school for two decades prior to becoming a public official.
Yeah, sure. And there's no question. I hope I didn't give the impression that every person who is associated with any of these schools is some kind of shyster. There's a lot of very reputable people at these schools, at Rochester Prep, and I think at all the other charter schools in the community who absolutely have education first on their mind and are trying their best to make a difference in it. It's just a matter of what's the framework in place that looks at the finances and the management and that sort of thing, and how can compliance be improved, and how can the framework itself be improved to prevent things like discovering the Education Success Network from maybe unfairly tainting good actors elsewhere.
Jeff, thank you for taking the time, and I hope, I know it was, it's a busy schedule for today, but it's an open door here, and I hope we'll see you back soon.
Right. Anytime. Happy to.
Jeff Rosenberger is the board chair of Rochester Prep. That's a group of five charter schools in Rochester. We're going to get a short break and get more reaction from our panelists who are in studio, Shaggy Tell from Nazareth College and David Hirsch, a professor at the Warner School of Education at the University of Rochester and the author of the new book, The End of Public Schools. Justin Murphy from the Democrat and Chronicle is here as well. It was his recent report titled Charter Schools as Movement Grows, Oversight Lags, that helped spark this discussion. You can find it on the Democrat and Chronicle.com now, especially if you are a subscriber there. So let's get a short break and continue the discussion with your phone calls as well next. Coming up in our second hour, we're talking in our monthly science roundtable about the remarkable recent discovery of a ninth planet in our solar system. Now, it hasn't actually been discovered yet, but there is evidence that there is a large planet way out there past Neptune. Again, ninth planet, not Pluto. How do they know it's there? How come they can't see it yet? What are the implications for us? All of that next hour.
People in Flint, Michigan have a lot of questions for public officials, but the one on everyone's mind, when can they drink the water again?
When are you gonna fix it? And I mean fix it right.
We'll have a report from Flint, plus the latest from the campaign trail and the Iowa caucuses. That's later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI.
David Hirsch is a professor of education, and I want to start with him as we return to our conversation here on Connections about charter schools, inspired by the piece in the Democrat and Chronicle by Justin Murphy. We will get to your phone calls in a moment here, but David wants to have a chance to weigh in on some of what you just heard from Jeff Rosenberger, starting with how charter schools and the student body is made up in charter schools. What did you want to weigh in there, David?
Well, what Jeff mentioned was that they, he said, basically were blind in terms of admissions, so that implying that the student body for the charter schools should be similar to or reflect that the demographics of the city schools. And yet, if I look at the most recent figures I have is from 2014, and you can look up the demographics for students in all the charter schools in Rochester on your own, but I can see that they're much less diverse in terms of students who are English language learners and students with disabilities than the city school district. So, for example, the city school district has 18.8% of their students have a disability of one kind or another. The charter school's 8%, so less than half. In terms of English language learners, the city school district has 14%. The charter school's much less, 2.9%, and 55% of the charter schools have none. And so their student body is much different than the city school district in terms of the students who come in with challenges.
Yeah, is it possible, David, that the people who are applying and the families who are applying to have their children go to charter schools are simply a little less diverse, but that the charter schools aren't, I guess the question is whose fault is that?
Right. Well, it could be, that could be part of the explanation, and it could be then whose fault is it might be that when parents are looking at the schools, they can see that they're not dealing with students who are English language learners or students with disabilities and say, then I'm not going to apply for that. The other thing that charter schools can do, though, is if they don't feel that they can service the student because they require special needs that the school can't give, then they can return those students to the city school district. And so I don't know how that comes about, but there's several ways it could come about, and we just don't know what they are. But to imply that the demographics for the charter schools are similar to those of the city school district, I think is very misleading.
Yeah, they're not.
Right,
they're not.
But I thought he was implying in his answer that they, I think, basically they're open to any.
Yeah, right. I took it, David, as him saying, look, we're not out there recruiting only the top students, students of lacking diversity. We are open to everybody. Yeah. We don't know, we couldn't know. And, if it shakes out that way, it's not because we are trying to make it so.
Well, you could not, maybe that in the aim to save money, you could be not hiring the people that you need to have in order to serve a diverse range of students.
Professor Tell?
Yeah, there was a piece by Kevin Wellner from the National Education Policy Center just a few years ago. It's called The Dirty Dozen, and it's basically a list of 12 ways charter schools screen students and engage in selective enrollment and attrition practices, mainly to affect their test scores and charter renewal chances. And you can just Google it, it'll come up. And here are some of the ways that charter schools selectively enroll students. So Jeff says we can't do this and we don't do that. Some of those things are technically true, so you can't quibble with them that way. But here are some ways that charter schools select. Kevin says applications are made available just a few hours a year sometimes. Lengthy application forms often printed only in English that require student and parent essays, report cards.
Jeff did say specifically in an email this morning they do advertise in Spanish as well.
Good, because several schools in New Orleans are being sued by Vietnamese parents and Hispanic parents for printing only in English. So the other way is demands that students present social security cards and birth certificates for their applications to be considered, even though such documents cannot be required under federal law. Another way is mandatory family interviews, assessment exams, academic prerequisites, and on it goes. I've read in the 8-9 years that I've been researching the topic that some charter schools just literally come out and say, no, you're not going to enroll here. Others have kinder, more gentler ways of counseling you out and pushing you out. And others have ways of admitting you and then creating a paper trail and a pathway to leak you out, as they say, leak you out if and when the need arises. The harsh reality is that charter schools do increase segregation, according to the literature.
Justin Murphy, as a reporter, do you have any evidence locally that charter schools are behaving in that way, counseling out intentionally in that way?
No, and I've collected some data from the city school district. I've given a lot of thought of what's the best way to attack that question, because it's certainly an allegation that you hear a lot. So I asked the city school district for evidence for every time a student reentered the district from a charter school, the date and the school that they came from. And I haven't published anything about that yet, but it's not startling. What you might think you could get, for instance, is dozens and dozens of kids coming back the week before testing in the spring. And that's not quite the case.
Okay. Before I get to the phones, one other quick point here, and I want to stress to our listeners that we just had Jeff Rosenberger on the program in the first half hour. He's the board chair of Rochester Prep. Jeff emailed me this morning with just sort of a list of his feelings after reading Justin's piece, and I just essentially reached back out and said, come on the program, and he was kind enough to do that. Many of the other people in the charter schools community that we reached out to simply said they were not available today for various reasons. I hope that changes in the days and weeks to come, but we certainly didn't want to have it imbalanced. So by way of trying to continue with at least a semblance of balance here, let me read one other part of Jeff's email. We'll get the panel's reaction and then your phone calls for the rest of the hour. So here's what Jeff writes as well that we didn't quite get to with him, but on the same tack of who is working for either boards or, you know, sort of in this charter school community. And he writes that in Justin Murphy's article, he wrote, quote, a January 2013 audit of Rochester's Eugenia Maria de Hostos Charter School, for example, revealed that the school had entered into a building lease and instructional contract with entities affiliated with board members, end quote. And Jeff writes, that's true. What he neglected to tell the readers is the board member in question is George Rommel. The organization he heads is the YMCA, not exactly a nefarious organization. And he's saying, you know, most people would support that. So, Justin, I think that extends what we were just talking about with Jeff, which is that in many of these cases, he views the people who are on the board or providing some of the services as not as nefarious or venal types, but those who have things that the charter school community needs and they can help them with.
Sure, that's very often true. And I think that I would agree with him that no one would accuse the YMCA of running some kind of long con to make a few thousand dollars off a local charter school in Rochester. But even when you're having contracts, as you sometimes will, with friendly negotiators, there needs to be a structure in place that you can do that in a way that puts it above suspicion. State law is pretty clear on that. And that's why they were cited in the audit. That's also why the same audit cited the school for putting out a cleaning contract with a company controlled by one of the board members' brothers. So it's not necessarily a problem that they're working with the YMCA, but if you do it in such a way that it raises questions, not necessarily that the YMCA is running some kind of racket, but for instance, when you're at the negotiating table hammering out the terms of the contract, you would hope that the school, which is using public funding to support their operation, is going to really go after that last $5,000, $1,000, $500 in the contract to wring as much value out of it as they can. Is that necessarily going to be the case if the guy writing the check is sitting at the table? It might not be in the same way.
Okay. David Hirsch, thoughts on that? Anything else you want to add before we turn to our listeners here?
Well, I want to add one other issue that we've kind of touched on but haven't quite, and that is the ways in which urban schools and the city school districts being portrayed as failing. And I think that's, as I've been in education for 40 years, and I've been working hard at improving schools, and I agree that the city school district, and in fact all the schools I've worked with, could be better. The problem I have is that they're being portrayed as failing based on test scores, which are often manipulated in ways to intentionally reveal schools as failing. And those low test scores are then being used to advocate for charter schools and other means of privatization. So I think there's a bigger issue here in terms of that charter schools are part of a movement to try to privatize education in the United States in general. And we see a number of donors, from including a lot of neoliberal foundations, who were putting money into charter schools. And we're talking about, like, from the Walton Family Foundation putting in $1 billion, the Gates Foundation also putting in a similar amount. And their aim is to put people in control. Well, their aim, among other things, the Gates Foundation has managed to support the New Schools Ventures Fund, which is an effort to privatize schools as charter schools. And many of the administrative assistants to Arne Duncan and now King come from the charter school network and from organizations that are working to support charter schools. So we have at this point many of the people in leadership positions in education are promoting privatization as the solution to education. And I think that's the danger, is that now we're talking about that we don't need to improve education, and we also can ignore the issue of poverty, and the claim is made if we just privatize schools, all will be fine.
I think there's something philosophical. I think there's a philosophical divide here. I think a lot of people who support the charter school model do believe that there is a big problem, usually in urban education.
Yes, there is a problem.
And that they don't trust what the system has been doing, and that they do want to try different things. And whereas a lot of other people would say, on the other side, fix poverty, and you've done a long way to fixing schools.
Right.
And I think that divide is at the heart of this, yes?
Right. I agree that that's at the heart of it. And I think poverty, which has been ignored for a long time, is now being put on the agenda as people are seeing the kind of inequality growing in the United States and wanting to do something about that. Because it's, you know, we have this data coming in terms of the degree of poverty in Rochester. And those facts can't be just ignored any longer.
Okay. Shaggy Tell, go ahead.
Yeah, sure. In many ways, it is about the deepening and worsening problem of poverty, especially poverty that's expanding in the suburbs and all over the place. And so the logic is that poverty is too big a problem. It can't be solved, and it's not on the immediate agenda. So therefore, we have to create these privatized schools of choice and solve problems that way. But why not actually create a fully funded, excellent, universal public school system and go that way? There's no shortage of money. And poverty is actually a solvable problem in the here and now. It's not a pie-in-the-sky goal.
All right, I want to get to your phone calls. And the first phone call comes from a Rochester School Board member. This is Willa Powell weighing in. Go ahead, Willa.
Hi, good afternoon. How are you?
Good. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Good. Well, I have quite a lengthy list of points I'd like to make. It's too bad that Jeff isn't there, so I'll keep my points to two basic thoughts, if you don't mind. The first is the question of oversight, and Dr. Patel is exactly right. Just because you say a charter school is public over and over doesn't make it so. The fact is that if it weren't for the work that Justin did with the Freedom of Information Act and his time and energy, these charter schools wouldn't be accountable because they're exempt from state auditing requirements. On a related point, the CFO of Buffalo School District a couple of years ago discovered, also through Freedom of Information Act derived information, that several of the charter schools in Buffalo had reserves of 50 to 100% of their avenue revenue. Now, reserves in the not-for-profit world is the term for profits. And there's no public school anywhere that has a reserve that large. In fact, public schools, traditional public schools, are prohibited from holding unrestricted reserves over 4%. So it's difficult to argue that these not-for-profit organizations aren't profiting. The second point I want to disagree with Justin, though, about is the facilities question. You notice that the charter school entities are now clamoring for facilities funding, but, you know, the presumption of the original charter school enabling legislation was that if a charter applicant couldn't make a go of it on the aid that's stipulated in the law, then they shouldn't apply. And yet there was there's a never-ending stream of charter applications without facilities funding. So So they're, aside from being exempt from any facilities funding, they're also exempt from certain facilities requirements, which means that they can house classrooms less expensively than we can in the traditional public schools. Now that they're entrenched as an institution, now they want to change the rules, and that's without they're not willing to allow for a greater oversight and accountability through audits to show that they actually need facilities funding that their current per pupil aid won't cover that.
All right, so Justin, you seem to take at least a little quibble with that part on the facility side. Go ahead.
Yeah, and I'm not sure exactly what Will is referring to, but in terms of the auditing by the Attorney General, charter schools in the last several years have been subject to that. With the facilities, I think it's hard if the concern with charter schools is that the private sector has too much of an influence in the way that the schools work. It would be dangerous to then say, but we're expecting you to come up with all of the money privately for the facilities. If we want them to be public, then there are certain things that we mean by that, and one of them is how you handle the facilities. I think that, you know, we're talking about a lot of sort of high-level topics about profit motive and the Gates Foundation and all that sort of thing, and kind of having a debate on whether charter schools are a good thing. And that's fine, and that's a valid debate, certainly, but I want to be clear that that's not what I was trying to litigate in this piece. The fact is that charter schools exist. There are several thousand students in Rochester attending them, and many more thousands in other cities. And the question is, are the current rules in place to not only for the state to police them, but are they properly regulating themselves? And I think that the worry is that this is becoming an issue like so many issues today, that the two sides have been so entrenched that charter school supporters don't feel free to say, here is an example of a bad charter school, we need to do something about this, or we need to change this practice. Because if they do, they're showing a vulnerability, and they're afraid that the whole house can come tumbling down. Just like on the other side, I would say that in my opinion, people like David or Shoggy or Willa are sometimes intentionally ignoring positive developments that are coming out of charter schools, the innovations that are coming from their curriculum and their ways of teaching, just like they were supposed to. I think the public school side isn't always seeing that, because they see every per pupil cost that goes out as an existential threat to the public system.
Willa, some final thoughts before I turn to other callers. Go ahead.
Well, keep in mind, I haven't expressed any opinion ever for or against charter schools, but the fact remains that the charter schools are eager to take the exemption and then ask for more. Justin himself said that they're being audited by the Attorney General, but they're exempt from auditing by the Comptroller in the state of New York. If they'd been if they were required to be audited by the Comptroller, it might never have reached a level of having to be pursued by the Attorney General.
I'm sorry, Will, I misspoke. They are subject to Comptroller audits. I said Attorney General. I meant Comptroller. And in fact, some of these schools have been audited by the Comptroller.
That's interesting, because, I'll look into that myself. Thank you. But the point is, and going back to the facilities, I'm not saying that there should be an expectation that the charter applicant go out and raise private dollars from philanthropic organizations. I'm saying when they submit their application, they have to have a plan. Now, if they get approved on a plan that says we're going to raise money from charity, that's fine. If they say we're going to pay for facilities by paying rent from our per pupil aid, that's fine. But it's stated in the application, and that's how they get approved. And if they don't like that, they shouldn't apply.
All right, Will, I've got to get to other calls here because we're going to lose the hour here. But I know, you know, some of our panel, I think, is inclined to agree with some of that. Here's a listener. Trish just wants to know on Twitter, are the donations that these generous philanthropists give to charter schools tax deductible?
I can tell you Kenneth Saltman has done some work on this and has shown, Philip Kovacs has also done some work on this, but shown that these so-called donations or these philanthropic movements are tax deductible and feed into the tax shelter arrangements. So it's not always as benevolent as the impression is created.
Okay, Marco writes to us on Twitter, Rochester charter schools provide great opportunities that aren't otherwise available. And he says, if you actually went to one, you'd see how diverse they actually are. And again, in terms of racial diversity, 97% of Jeff Rosenberger's Rochester Prep, he's a board chair of Rochester Prep, 97% of their students are non-white. But what David Hirsch was saying earlier was diverse as in students with various disabilities, and English language, English as a second language, et cetera.
But you just mentioned that 97% non-white.
85% free and reduced lunch
there. But the research also shows that the charter schools have increased segregation in their schools in comparison to the districts they're in. So I realize that we don't have an integrated, we have a city school district that's 90% not white, but then the charter schools even more so. So they're often entirely students of color.
All right, David in Pittsburgh. I want to make sure we get a few more phone calls in. David in Pittsburgh, go ahead.
Yeah, I'll be quick here. First, the application process is deeply flawed because it requires an application. You don't have to fill out an application with parental involvement in order to get into a city school. and the mere fact that there's parental involvement already makes a large difference in the nature of the student.
That's a common argument, that it sort of self-selects for kids who are sort of in better family standing to begin with.
So I would suggest that in order to be fair about this thing, allow the city to assign the kids to the charter schools the same way as they assign the kids to the public schools. Second, the city has already paid for the facilities for all of the students in the city, and now the charter schools want them to pay over again after, when they remove kids from facilities that have already been built. And my third comment is, if I remember right, her name is Elaine Moskowitz, who's being paid over $500,000 for running charter schools. Mm-hmm. So the argument that the charter schools aren't siphoning off funds in a rather blatant way, I think, is pretty weak.
David, thanks for the phone calls.
Well, I think you also have to add to that according to my research, about 120 to 200 charter schools close each year, and that's with poor oversight, meaning that if oversight were actually effective and serious, you could probably see way more than that closing. And we also have to remember that there's a very high rate of student, teacher, and principal turnover in charter schools, much higher than in public schools and higher than in urban public settings. So, yeah, you do have a lot of students and parents enrolling in charter schools. And by the way, charter schools choose you more than you choose them. But they don't necessarily always stay there. And it's usually they've had a range of negative experiences. So if you're going to subject educational arrangements to the chaos and anarchy of the free market, that's what you're going to get.
We had some questions online from a couple of different listeners about the rate of attrition, and I don't know the answers sort of writ large in this fashion. For those who have complained that there's no one from the charter schools world in studio on this panel, unfortunately, I'm just going to sort of say that's baloney. We have reached out to a lot of different people in the last week, and a lot of people were not available, not even available for a 5-minute pre-recorded phone interview. So there were a lot of options for that. But Jeff Rosenberger stepped up and was on the program for the first half hour, generously gave his time. He's the board chair of Rochester Prep. There will be plenty of opportunities in the future. We're going to continue that conversation. And go back about a month. We had a conversation on this program after the New York Times published an article about a downstate, I think it was a New York City charter school, with a got-to-go list, a so-called got-to-go list.
Eva Moskow was the school.
Exactly right. And
Success Academy.
And so we had listeners saying, is that what's happening here? So I said, well, let's bring some heads of local charter schools on to talk about your process. What is the lottery process? How does it work? What are your numbers like? Now, they told me attrition is not essentially a problem, that you don't see a lot of students who start there but don't finish it. Justin, I haven't really researched myself on that. Have you?
I don't think it's probably as big of a problem as it is in some of the New York City schools. And I think it's also important throughout this, whatever conversation you have about charter schools, to realize that there's quite a wide variety. I can say I've been in classrooms in most of the charter schools in Rochester, and there are a couple that I think anyone would be lucky to have their children attend, and there's one that is by far the worst school I've ever been inside in my life, and I won't say which one it is, but the point of charter schools, I think, is that it introduces variety and choices for parents and different educational styles, and that does exist for better and worse.
Okay, well, Justin Murphy's piece, we posted it in various places, including my Twitter feed. It's Charter Schools, As Movement Grows, Oversight Lags, and the Democrat and Chronicle. You can find it now. Justin, thanks for the work and for coming in and talking more about it on the program today.
You're welcome.
David Hirsch, I know we're going to talk to you more because his new book is called The End of Public Schools, and I hope we can schedule a visit soon to talk about
great.
That. So the book's out now. And it's by David Hirsch, who's a professor of teaching and curriculum at the University of Rochester's Warner School of Education. Shaggy Tell, associate professor of social foundations of education at Nazareth. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Nice,
thank you.
Nice having you here. And listeners, again, this conversation continues. I promise we're nowhere near done with education or charter schools. Short break and the Science Roundtable is next.